Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f-. So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Quality sleep is essential. That's why the Sleep Number Smart Bed is designed for your ever-evolving sleep needs. Need a bed that's firmer or softer on either side? Helps you sleep at a comfortable temperature? Sleep Number smart beds let you individualize your comfort, so you sleep better together. J.D. Power ranks Sleep Number number one in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, save 50% on the Sleep Number limited edition smart bed for a limited time. For J.D. Power 2023 award information, visit jdpower.com/awards. Only at a Sleep Number store or sleepnumber.com.
I'm author and journalist Laura Price, and you're listening to Life in Food, inspiring stories in bite-sized pieces. Each episode, I interview a different guest about how food has helped them through some of their biggest challenges. With a different theme each week, we look at everything from food and love to food and friendship, food and fertility, and even food and grief. This week's episode is food and social media with Sarah Tasker, host of the Hashtag Authentic podcast, as well as photographer, writer, social media expert, and coach. Sarah has an incredibly successful business giving classes and one-to-one coaching to help people build their Instagram followings in the most authentic ways and to help them to achieve their business goals. She came to this particular career after leaving the NHS, and she's been hugely successful, running a multi-six-figure business even while living with a chronic illness that causes extreme fatigue and sometimes makes it difficult to leave the house. I've been using Instagram for 10 years now in my role as a food journalist and also as a restaurant enthusiast and author, and I'm fascinated by the way it's evolved and how there's now a huge cavern between Instagram versus reality. I'm going to be talking to Sarah about those changes and how we can still use social media to truly connect people through food and beyond. Sarah, thank you for joining me and welcome to Life in Food.
Thank you for having me. What a lovely intro. It makes me sound so professional.
Well, you are, and I've been following you for quite a few years now, and it's just been amazing to see the evolution of your own career as well.
It's been a joy. Yeah, it's been such an adventure. Instagram changed my life. I'm a big fan.
Oh, God. Well, first of all, could you tell us about what you do in your own words and also how Instagram changed your life?
What I do in my own words. I sometimes dread that question. You know, when you get in a lift with someone and they're like, so what do you do? And you think, oh, no, I don't have a clean answer to this. I do a bit of everything I want to do. So I do some coaching. I do some education. I do some writing. I'm writing a novel. I have a podcast. I have a book. I do some speaking events, and the joy of that is I get to constantly pivot to whatever is matching my enthusiasm at the moment, or matching my focus or my interest, or also matching what my body will agree to do with my health. And Instagram was the gateway to all of that, because Instagram is how I found an audience for what I have to share. It started as just photography and writing. It was just personal writing, almost lifestyle blogging at the beginning. And as I learned that people were especially interested in my insights on social media, kind of lent into that, and it evolved into my business. And so I'm really passionate about this idea of social media as a way to connect us with the people who want to hear what we have to say. And that direct connection is quite new. If you think like traditional industries, as a journalist, you'll know you go through something else. You write, it goes in a publication which has an audience, and then it gets to the audience. So there's always that barrier. You know, you make movies and then it goes to the studio and then it goes out. So this is the first time, really, I think we've had this ability to have that direct relationship with our audience. So whatever it is you want to do in the world, it's such a powerful thing.
Amazing. You're basically living the freelance dream, I think, that we all want to do.
I think I am. I have to say it still has its stresses.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, I'm sure it does.
Sadly.
You actually left a job in the NHS to do what you do. Can you tell us how that came about?
Yeah, so I was working in speech therapy, pediatric speech therapy, and I'd started this Instagram account on my maternity leave and it was growing, but this was back when, like, there was no such thing as an Instagram career. There was no such thing as an influencer even. And so I'd spend my lunch breaks emailing brands to try and get brand partnerships, because I just had this sense that this was something, I could tell it was going somewhere. I could tell it had momentum and it had potential. And I'd done that thing that a lot of women do where after you go back to your career after maternity leave, it just doesn't fit anymore. It didn't fit for me to be out of the house every day away from my daughter, and it didn't fit for my health as my health was kind of declining. I was like pulling over the car and having naps in between home visits. And so I was very aware that this could be a way out. But even when my goal was just to match my income every month from the Instagram work, and even when I got there, I still probably stayed for another 4 or 5 months longer than I needed to, because it was really frightening to take the leap into the freelance dream. And then very quickly realized I didn't want to be dependent on those brand partnerships full time, because you very much have to sort of sell out your voice if, you know, if that's the only way you can pay the bills. So that's when I started to sort of diversify the business a bit.
I love the fact that you've been super open about your earnings as well. I remember a tweet that you did years ago now about how much you'd earned in that year, and it got really positive responses, didn't it?
It did. It was interesting. It got really positive responses on Twitter, and it got mostly positive responses, but some negative on Instagram.
Really?
Which is maybe just a snapshot of where people's minds are at. I spoke about, I think that year I'd made about 250K. From my kitchen table, like not even having a desk, just me and my laptop that I'd have to shove out the way when it was tea time. And previously, like working for the NHS, I think I made about 20K a year. Like frequently had like red bills coming through the door, and I was in all sorts of debt and did not manage my money very well at all, and struggled in the way that I think most of us would on 20K a year. And so that's been a whole transformation and journey, kind of having money when I'd never had money before, wasn't brought up having money. A delight, amazing, but an education as well.
How did you do that? Because obviously, you know, everyone wants to earn the sort of money that you're earning from the job that you're doing, which appears to be a dream job. Do you have any kind of top line tips?
So for me, it was about making something that was really scalable. So I started, at first I was just doing one-to-one coaching, and I very quickly realized there was only one of me, I had limited hours. Mm. You can't, you know, then that's the problem as a freelance writer a lot of the time, isn't it? There's only so much you can charge per piece, and there's only so many pieces you can write in a week. So for me, it was delivering classes online and scaling up that education, because I was realizing I was saying the same things to all these clients over and over. So I was like, what if I could say this to loads of people at once, set it at a lower price point, but it was still, you know, when 100 people buy something at £200-300, then you very quickly start to see that scale. And so I've carried on doing that, kind of those classes, making sure, because I have this background in schools and in education, trying to make sure that they actually work, that they're classes that actually you get through and you come out at the end with the results and the skills that you need, and trying to make sure that they deliver on the value and that they can reach as many people as possible.
Amazing. That's really good advice. Thank you. You describe yourself on your website as 40% photographer, 40% writer, 40% coach, and 10% cake. And you admit that you're terrible at maths, which so am I. So I think that's a good prompt for us to start to talk about your relationship with food. Mm. How was your relationship with food when you were growing up, and what's it like now?
So I kind of had this split world of food growing up. So my grandparents lived next door, and my parents' home was very much 80s convenience food. It was like those kind of floppy oven chips, like slightly strange offal with unhealthy amounts of salt in breadcrumbs, you know, those kind of like cheap convenience food. And then my grandma would home cook everything in that traditional kind of grandma way and was an amazing cook. So everything I know about cooking came from her, everything I know about baking, everything I know about nice food came from her. And still now, like, all of my favorite recipes are things that she taught me.
Okay. And I should say that we're from a very similar place. We're both from West Yorkshire, yes. Although you still live there and I sadly don't. you're not a food blogger or a food influencer per se, but you do post quite a lot of photos of pastries and beautiful bread and coffees and these gorgeous layouts of breakfasts. And I confess, Sarah, I've been to the bottom of your Instagram feed and you did post a plate of sausages and some beautiful quality streets wrappers, yeah, back in the day. I wanted to ask, why do you think food took off on Instagram so spectacularly from the beginning?
Such a good question. I think food is lifestyle, right? Like Instagram in the beginning was everyone showing their life and their personal experience of the world. And what works even to this day on Instagram is anything that engages our senses and makes us feel like it's a moment that we kind of can be drawn into. And food is so powerful for that, because as soon as you look at lemons, you know the taste of lemons. As soon as you see a plate of sausages, you're like, I know what that's like. And food has such a sense of place and moment to it. Like you mentioned the pastries and coffee, because for me, that is a point in the day where everything stops and things are beautiful and things are intentional and you engage in your senses and you're kind of stopping to be where you are. And seeing that, the next best thing to having that personally is to see it on your screen. And it's kind of a reminder that those check-in points with your body and with the world around you exist.
And how do you think food on Instagram has changed since the days when we were all just posting our avocado on toast with eggs?
It's definitely changed. And maybe it's slightly tragically changed, I think. Like I have a lot of thoughts at the moment on how we've evolved from this place where we all just shared for the joy of sharing. Back in the day, the very early days of Instagram, there was no expectation of a career from it or profit even from it. It was just for the fun and maybe for the numbers, like as an ego boost at most. So there was a lot of honesty to it then, right? Like you would just share what was real. You'd share the burnt cake or you'd share, I don't know, like the messy plates at the end of the meal. And we've sort of become so strategic about Instagram now that the food you see is food. It's being shared not for the motivation of connection. Most of the time it's being shared for the motivation of growth and profit and like momentum for that account holder. And I think that does show, because you have these huge trends in food now. You know, there's certain kind of rules to what food will perform well on Instagram and what won't. Certainly a plate of sausages would not expect that to perform well on Instagram in this day and age, but like a rainbow fruit bowl would, I imagine, do far better. And it's partly visual. There is probably a whole episode's worth we could dig into in the kind of the food as medicine, food, like purity, clean eating versus unclean eating. Like those things live and breathe on Instagram and they have a huge hold on people. So for that reason, the plate of sausages would not do as well as the fruit, because I think people feel virtuous engaging with the fruit and feel sinful engaging with sausages.
Yeah. Well, on that same note, I remembered a meme that I saw, again, it was about 5 or 6 years ago. And it's a waiter standing over someone's table saying, "Is everything okay? You've not photographed your food." And it reminded me of, and I'm totally guilty of photographing my food all the time, by the way. It reminded me of like, kind of since then, because that was early days. Since then, we've seen restaurants and places and even people at home photographing food or eating food or going to restaurants just to take a photo of a particular thing. So you mentioned the rainbow fruit bowls, but there was the rainbow bagels trend. There was the freak shakes, and people, I don't think, were necessarily eating these things. It's similar to the trend where we've heard about model influencers hiring private jets just to take a shot on a private jet, to do an Instagram shoot on a private jet and get off again. And they never actually flew on it. Do you think that social media is making us less authentic in our decisions, I guess?
Do you know, I don't actually think it is changing like the fabric of who we are. And the reason I say that is I think this instinct to pretend or to show like a glossy version of ourselves has always existed. Like I talked about my grandma, I think about how she would like shine her letterbox and her doorstep so that it looked good to the outside world. And the rest of her house was not that shiny. Sorry, Grandma, but it wasn't. But it was that thing of like, we want people to have a certain impression of us. You know, like your mother-in-law comes over and you quickly tidy up, or you put an outfit on in the morning and you're like, no, that doesn't look as good as I want it to. So you put another one on and maybe another one on. And I think it's that same instinct of believing we can control people's perceptions of us, which, by the way, I think is a lie, but believing that we can by what we show to the world. So it's maybe a more sort of strange, possibly sinister manifestation of that. But I think it's an instinct that's always existed and that we've always honored. So I don't worry about like the fabric of society because of Instagram. I think it's okay. But I think it's interesting. And I do think, like, what does it do to our brains if we believe that everyone else is actually eating all of this stuff? Because food is so complicated. And I hope it's all right to talk about this, Laura, but like, I think as women, our relationship with food is always more complicated because of our relationship to body image and the messages we get about weight gain. And Instagram definitely has a really big role to play in that. And it seems to me a really big shame that we had this medium where we could be actually peeking into each other's lives and it had the potential to normalize everything. And yet again, we've just turned it into another glossy magazine that tells us lies.
Yeah, I agree. Although I do think that it's also become a place for people to show that added authenticity. You know, we had the body positivity movement, and we've got people like, unfortunately, I don't know how to pronounce her name, but Danai Mercer, posting these brilliant images of like the real life version of the Instagram photo versus what you actually look like before you've done the pose. So it's got that positive angle as well.
You're right. And that's actually really important that we acknowledge. And I think that is a backlash to the kind of the trend in the opposite direction. Mm. And the trend is not real. I think it's partly driven by us, but a lot of it's driven by the algorithms. It's Instagram was much more democratic and much more open before these algorithmic systems came in, and now you have to play the game, you have to sort of chase the numbers, and the numbers encourage things that often aren't as authentic.
Yeah, and that's so true, because before, I remember when we first started on Instagram over 10 years ago, most of us had our accounts set to private, I would say. And I would say now there's more of a, you kind of create an Instagram in order to be public. And it's sort of, in a way, an amplification of, because I totally agree with what you say about your mother-in-law coming around. You know, we all put on, we have a public self and a private self. And Instagram is almost like the amplification of the mother-in-law coming around, except that you're showing your outside, your public life to the whole world versus just your mother-in-law.
Yeah.
And How do you think that Instagram versus reality can affect your mental health, if at all? And does it affect your own mental health?
I mean, there's been a lot shared on this already, hasn't there? And we do know it does affect people's mental health, especially in regards to things like body image and just this idea that other people are living a better life than you. And I think the only solution to that is media literacy. I only think that we can all learn and teach our children that it's not reality. My daughter's 9 now, and she's kind of getting into like YouTubers, and we have a lot of conversations where I have to remind her, like, okay, but you know that that's not all true. You know that's not their whole life, because what you see, even if you are amplifying that public self, is like 1%, isn't it, of the real world. So I think it can be a dangerous thing, but I think you're right that the kind of the backlash to that and the increase in authenticity and the potential for authenticity that is always there is a really, really beautiful counter to that. And hopefully, my hope is that the good done by that will outweigh the bad, because I think the bad is the bad that always existed, right? We've always seen people who were far too thin living far too nice lives, eating far too healthy food. Like when I was younger, it was like glossy magazines. Now it's Instagram. But if you want to feed your brain that, you're always going to find it. But when we were younger, where did you go for anything else? Where did you go for body positivity or like a realistic food diary of your day? It didn't even exist. And at least now it is out there. And I have to say, like, when I made an intentional choice to fill my Instagram feed with bodies that looked like mine, I'd gained weight due to my health, and was like, I'm going to look for people who've who have gained weight and follow people with different size bodies. And it took a very short amount of time for me to normalize that. I remember looking at myself in a swimsuit in the mirror and being like, oh, I look like the model. And I was like, oh my God, look at that. Like 2 weeks of changing my Instagram feed and already I've stopped hating myself.
That's really interesting and such good advice as well to, you know, follow the people that look more like you if that's something that affects you.
And also I think people that don't look like you but that don't look like everyone else, right? Yeah. Like that diversity is so important and it shows that our brains are very malleable and like all we have to do is be more intentional about what we put in and very quickly the thoughts that come out can be improved upon.
Yeah. You run a podcast called Hashtag Authentic and you've written a book of the same name. How do you think listeners can kind of achieve a better balance between Instagram and reality?
The kind of overarching message that I teach, and I teach it because it's the truest thing I've ever learned, is that the secret to whatever it is you're trying to unlock, whether it's like financial success, whether it's audience building, whether it's connection with other people, is to just be more you, just be exactly who you are. And it sounds so simple, but it's like the hardest thing to do in a world that has spent your whole life telling you that who you are is not right or not enough. But we like, it's so clear to me every time I speak to someone, every time I coach someone, they the thing that they are most frightened about people finding out about them is the thing that people would love to know and relate to so much and celebrate for them and make space for. So that's kind of my mission. It's like to help everyone kind of uncover that. And I think that that is the way to navigate this, is that if you can give yourself permission to be exactly who you are, then there's no danger of all these other things influencing you because you know who you are and you're rooted in that and you're showing up as that. You're not trying to pretend to be anything you're not. It's, yeah, it's one of those, it sounds like such a kind of a toxic positivity message if you kind of don't dig into it, because it's the hardest thing in the world to do. We have so many layers of protection over it. But Instagram is the perfect place to explore it because you can just kind of dip a toe into the water, just admit to something like, actually, like my house is a mess. Actually, I have a cupboard that the doors won't shut because everything's coming out, or whatever the fear is. And when everyone's like, me too, oh my God, suddenly you start to get that permission to just be exactly who you are.
Selling a little or a lot? Shopify helps you do your thing however you cha-ching. Shopify is the global commerce platform that helps you sell at every stage of your business. From the launch your online shop stage to the first real-life store stage, all the way to the did we just hit a million orders stage, Shopify is there to help you grow. Shopify helps you turn browsers into buyers with the internet's best converting checkout. 36% better on average compared to other leading commerce platforms. Because businesses that grow, grow with Shopify. Get a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/work. Shopify.com/work.
Hey, it's Ryan Reynolds, and I'm here with Keith, co-star of my upcoming film, If, only in theaters May 17th. Do you want to tell people the big news? All right, I'll do. Sign up now and you'll get unlimited for $15 a month and 6 months of Paramount Plus Essential Plan on us.
Mintmobile.com/switch.
Upfront payment of $45 equivalent to $15 per month. Unlimited over 40 gigabytes per month. Face lower speeds. Videos at 480p. Active Mint customers by 531.24 get 6 months of Paramount Plus Essential Plan. Auto renews after 6 months. Offer ends May 31st, 2024. Separate Paramount Plus registration required. Terms and conditions apply if rated PG.
Hey, it's Danny Pellegrino from Everything Iconic. Ready to upgrade your style game without blowing your budget? Check out Quince. They've got all the good stuff, shirts and polos, activewear and fine leather goods, all at 50 to 80% less than other high-end brands. And the best part? They're all about safe, ethical and responsible manufacturing. Get that luxury vibe without the luxury price tag. Hit up Quince.com/upgrade for free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. That's Quince.com/upgrade.
Hey, folks, I'm Mark Maron from the WTF podcast, and this episode is brought to you by Kleenex Ultra Soft Tissues, your ally to help tackle your allergy symptoms this season. I love the change of seasons, but nobody loves pollen and all those other things floating in the air that make you sneeze during this nice weather. Kleenex Ultra Soft Tissues are hypoallergenic and allergist approved. So fight back against watery eyes and runny noses without worrying about irritating your skin. For this allergy season, grab Kleenex and face allergies head on.
Someone I follow who does that brilliantly is Dawn O'Porter.
Yeah.
She's obviously got millions of followers and she's famous anyway, but she really does that well. Like, she'll share a photo of her close-up face. She's obviously not taken 17 selfies to get that one picture. And you can just see the messiness as well as the glamour of her life, which I think makes her a great role model.
Definitely. And what I say to people is, like, if you're not ready for that, like, you don't have to jump straight in at the deep end. If you are someone who's, like, addicted to face filters, post a selfie with a face filter by all means, but maybe mention that you did. Like, just that first dip in of, like, I don't like to post pictures of my face without a face filter will give everyone else so much permission to look at, like, where that shows up for them.
Yeah, I found Instagram challenging over the years, and it goes back to what you said before about being your true self. I've had two Instagram accounts. One of them started as my private personal one that just had my friends on it 10 years ago. And then later on, when I got a job writing about restaurants, I started a foodie one. Mm. And that one became followed by lots of predominantly male chefs. And then a few years later, I made my private one public because I was releasing a novel and I wanted to sort of open up that life about the breast cancer experience that I'd had. And I now have one that's kind of more me personal, talking about my breast cancer experience. And then I have this foodie one, which is followed by women. And then they have this foodie one, which is followed by men. And I'm now like, I don't know whether to just blend them. And actually, the people that follow the foodie one do know me as a person. And I recently shared a video about my breast cancer experience, which I was relating to food via this podcast. So it made sense to both of them. But I'm just so confused about which to do and what to do on which, and whether to just make them all into one and be my full self talking about food and cancer and books and everything else.
See, I don't think you are confused. I think you know exactly what you should do, but you're a bit scared to do it by the sounds of it.
Does that mean that you think I should make just one?
Yeah, I always think just have one, because otherwise you split, like, you double the workload and you have the rewards, because you've got to do twice as much to get the same engagement. And also, I think you're right. I think it's very easy to fall into that trap, like, well, the male chefs won't care, but the male chefs probably do love women, a lot of them, and have and care about you as a human, and food is so personal. So yeah, you don't want to shape your account for the imagined reaction of your followers, right? You want to shape your account for you and let the followers follow.
Yeah, really, really, really interesting. Do you see yourself as a brand?
I don't. I'm not very good at sticking to the idea that I'm a brand, actually. Like, I have got better at separating myself from the business, and sometimes I can make decisions that are good for the business instead of good for me personally. But no, I'm very much still a flawed, flailing human on the internet. Doing whatever I do. And yeah, for better or for worse, I think it's hard to remain authentic when you do go in too deeply into that brand pathway. Yeah. Like, all of my posts on social media are still me, written by me. I struggle to let go of that. Even emails, even sales emails, I'm like, no, I have to write it. It's got to be me, because that's my name at the bottom.
Yeah. Well, on a similar note, and on the subject of Instagram versus reality, you've shared that you live with a chronic illness. Are you able to tell us a little bit about that and whether it affects what you eat and how you eat?
Sure. So I have something called dysautonomia. In the US, it's often called POTS, postural orthostatic tachycardia syndrome. It basically means that anything that my body does autonomically or automatically can go haywire. So it's things like blood pressure, temperature control, digestion, the ability to stand upright, heart rate, just all the fun things. And it's very unpredictable, and some days are good and some days are awful. So in terms of food, absolutely. One of the big things for me is I'm hypervolemic, which means I never have quite enough blood in my body. Mm-hmm. And when you eat, all of the blood goes to your digestive system to do its thing. So that means there's no blood left in my head, basically. And I get very, very dizzy and sleepy, or I'll faint. So that's been really complicated to navigate with my relationship with food, because I think I do have probably layers of issues around anyway, kind of like tending towards restriction, tending towards kind of not necessarily the healthiest of eating patterns in regards to kind of trying to control my body image. So knowing that eating makes my symptoms worse, it's very easy to then kind of go into this, well, I just won't eat, and not eating is virtuous, not eating is good for me. But it's obviously also not. So navigating that has been really, really tricky. Carbohydrates definitely seem to make it worse, but I don't want to go down that whole like demonizing carbs route, because it's not evidence-based. It's not, you know, it's not something that's true for everybody. So it's kind of, the truth is it's just complicated. And I have these like, these rules for every meal I eat. I call it like my food filter, and I have to check in that what I'm eating is I'm choosing it with those values in mind and not getting pulled down the path of kind of other impulses. Is this all right to say, Laura?
Yeah, of course. Yeah. Not driven by Instagram or, you know, what food looks nice on Instagram, for example.
Right. Yeah, exactly. So it's, does it feel good in my body? Will it help my body feel good for the rest of today? Does it nourish my senses as well as my body? Those kind of questions, just checking in with myself so that I'm eating for the right reasons. I'm not eating because I'm bored, but I'm also not eating like just a plate of spinach because Instagram told me to. And just kind of staying in that intentional place has really helped me with eating in general, and kind of, you know, making sure I eat enough protein, all of those really basic things that help me stay well and functional most of the time. Some days it just doesn't work no matter what you try, but it's all a learning curve. And I do always imagine that I'll get to a point where I won't need that check-in and it will become easier. But like I say, food is complicated. Food can be so political, and we are exposed to so many influences around it. So I really try to be mindful and try to kind of educate myself on the places where the popular mythology about food maybe isn't telling us the whole truth.
Yeah, absolutely. And those decisions that you make daily about what you're putting in your body are actually decisions that we should all be making. But those of us who have, you know, I'm living with secondary breast cancer now.
Yeah.
Those of us who live with, you know, certain diseases, kind of, it's much more at the front of mind for us. But actually, everyone really should be making decisions consciously about what they put in their bodies every day. So
yeah, and it's hard to do that when you're so busy, when food can be such a dopamine reward, like it almost forces you to eat it. When food is just in the cupboard, like I always think about like hunter-gatherer times, you'd go out and you'd get what you could get and you'd choose it intentionally. You'd have so much time to think about what you were going to eat before you did. Whereas now eating, for me, it can very quickly become an automatic thing. I don't even know I'm doing it. And then the whole packet of popcorn is gone or whatever. So, and Laura, do you get lots of advice from people online about how you should be eating according to their beliefs?
I did. The very first time I had breast cancer 10 years ago, I did, because I was writing a blog and I experimented with a few things. Like I gave up sugar and dairy for a very short period of time before deciding that I actually just needed to have a better balance. And that certainly invited responses. But generally speaking, I don't get too much. It's something that I joked about in my novel with the character. It's called Single Bald Female, and she writes some posts online, and she gets lots of people commenting saying, have you tried turmeric, and have you tried turmeric lattes and all that, because those are genuinely things that people do say when you're first diagnosed. But I think possibly with me, people know that I've been around the block of breast cancer now, and they know perhaps not to suggest stuff that I've probably already tried.
Good. I think it's important that people recognize those boundaries. You get the same thing with chronic illness, like maybe you just need to do yoga and
or have some more sleep.
Try a crystal. And it's like, if those things help you, then that's awesome and you should absolutely keep them. This isn't me judging anyone else's. But like you say, when you've lived with something for a while, you've tried everything. You've tried you've not left a single stone unturned, and you find what works for you and what works to keep you kind of your brain healthy as well as your mind and your body and soul. And food is a pleasurable thing, and I honestly think it's supposed to be pleasurable. I think that it's one of the best things in the world, and to deprive ourselves in pursuit of kind of a certain type of body or a certain manifestation of health, I don't know if it ever works, because I think the compromise in joy and kind of feeling like everything's available to you often brings more negative consequences than we recognize.
It should be about nourishing the body and the soul, as opposed to growing a particular type of body, I think, on the outside. It's all about the inside.
You're saying it much better than me.
No, you fed me those ideas. You talked just then about feeding the soul, nourishing the soul. You've bought a beautiful house in France, which I think you're planning on moving to permanently. Is that right?
I'm planning on it. My husband and my daughter don't know yet. So,
oh, okay. Well, what was the dream that led you to buy this house in France, and how do you see your food lifestyle panning out over there?
Oh my goodness, the food in France is so good. Yeah, it was lockdown, and I got very claustrophobic living in the four walls, like I think all of us did. And I just wanted to be somewhere else. And so I started to look at French cottages online every day, obsessively, as you do, and fell in love with one. And then it sold and we couldn't buy it. So then I was just on a mission and found us one. And I mean, property in France is a lot cheaper, so it made it possible. But also the big draw for me really was the French culture, and a big part of that is food. Like the fact that you have to have a bakery in every village and it has to be open every day with fresh bread. Some villages don't have one, so they have a baguette ATM machine. I don't know if you've seen those.
No way. Like have you ever been to Japan?
No.
And they have not ATM machines, sorry, but they have vending machines on the street where you can buy like drinks and food and stuff, but they're just randomly on the street.
No way. So this is just for baguette, same thing. And I think it bakes it. I think it like has dough or has part baked bread in it, and then you can buy, it'll cook it for you on the side of the road something.
I did go to Bordeaux in August, and I remember seeing one now. It was outside like a spa shop, but yeah, I remembered seeing it thinking, wow.
It's like the law or something in France, you have to have bread. And I just think there's something about that prioritization of good food and the experience of it. And the French are very good at that. Like everything shuts down for an hour or two at lunchtime because everyone takes a proper lunch break. Mm. There's no Boots meal deal where you get it all in little packages and you can sit at your desk and eat it conveniently. Like you have to go and you get a fresh sandwich made, or you sit down somewhere and you have a proper meal and drink. And I really appreciate that. I think it's a really nourishing and healthy thing to have. And the fresh produce is so good. Like over there, I set my location to the French house for Facebook Marketplace. And like the things that come up in Halifax, like around here where I live, it's like wheelie bin stickers and Bratz dolls. And in France, it's people have grown too many tomatoes, so they're just giving crates of them away, and strawberries. Our house has got an orchard. It's got walnut trees. It's got like pear trees, apple trees, peach trees, just figs. It's amazing. And it's a different way of living. You feel so much more connected to the seasons. And the fresh produce is dreamy over there in a way that I don't enjoy it in the same way over here anymore.
No, I mean, and when we talk about healthy lifestyle, actually the lifestyle there, that what's healthy about it is not necessarily just the food itself, the fresh tomatoes, but it's the living around the growing of food.
Yes. So. Yeah. And the making time for food, like making time for meals and enjoying it. And and that kind of connection to what's in season. The markets, every village has a market. And in the summer where it's too hot to have markets, some of them have night markets because it's so important that you still go out and, you know, pick your food and choose your food. And it's that intentionality again, isn't it? It's very different. Like in the UK, I get HelloFresh, I get meal boxes delivered. And I love that. It's really convenient, but it's very unintentional. I don't get much say in what I'm eating each week. Whereas in that culture, it's like, well, of course you have time to go and choose individually which tomato you're going to eat and when. And I really love that. It's a total privilege. It's obviously a real luxury, but I really love it.
Yeah, I'm a big fan of that as well. So I'm going to start off by asking you the questions I ask everyone on this podcast. And I think the first one you've probably already answered, but I'll ask you anyway. Your relationship to food, fuel or pleasure?
I think pleasure. It has to be.
Favorite meal of the day?
Breakfast. I could eat breakfast at any hour.
That is reflected in your Instagram. Name one meal that always makes you feel happy.
Hot pot.
What kind of hot pot?
Well, Lancashire hot pot, because that's where my grandma was from. So it would be beef hot pot with like potatoes and carrots and onions.
That reminds me of Coronation Street. Was it Betty? Betty's hot pot.
Yes.
One food that has healed you.
Healed me. Bread. Bread is always there for me, whatever's going on.
One dish that reminds you of family.
Christmas dinner.
Ooh, yeah. One recipe that everyone should know how to cook.
A really good soup with whatever's in your fridge.
Soup makes it into almost every single one of these final questions in my podcast.
Really?
Everyone loves soup.
Love soup.
Your best meal ever.
It's my grandma's Christmas dinner.
Is your grandma still alive?
She isn't, but I do her justice every year with what she taught me, except she would have mushy peas in the Christmas dinner. I don't do that. I think it's a wartime leftover. So yeah. Sorry again, Grandma.
Do you have Yorkshire pudding?
Well, now I do. Again, that's sacrilegious. She'll be turning in her grave. But now I'm in Yorkshire. I feel like I owe it to my fellow countrymen.
Yeah. Final question. Some food for thought. What is the one piece of advice you would give to anyone about food and social media?
My advice would be to pay more attention to how food feels in your body than how food looks online, I think. And fill your feeds, fill your home feeds with other people who are doing the same thing.
See, there was that hashtag that took off a couple of years ago. Was it ugly delicious? I think it was. Yes. And actually there was that Dave Chang show, Ugly Delicious, on Netflix. But the problem with that is, because I think I'm with you on hot pots and anything that's basically a one pot dish, you know, fish pies, things like that. But they never look good on the gram. So
they look like slop, don't
what
they?
What can you do about that?
Round slop. You've got to have nice bowls and a little bit of a garnish.
got ya.
And I interviewed a food photographer in my Instagram class, a food stylist and photographer, and it was really interesting hearing her talk about how you represent flavors in photographs. She's called Kimberly Espinel. She has a book actually, and she's, yeah, like just the way that you can photograph food so that it kind of communicates the tastes. And she's got lots of ideas about things like that I'd never even thought of.
That's really interesting. Is that an episode on your podcast?
She's also on my podcast, yes, Kimberly Espinel. And then she actually did a little workshop for us in the Insta Retreat.
I'll have a look for it and I'll put the link in the show notes if I can find it. Sarah, thank you so much. It's been a total joy.
Thank you, Laura. I'm sorry I've been a bit waffly. I think it probably reflects the fact that my relationship with food is complicated still. And hopefully I made some sort of sense at some
point. Totally, yeah. Not waffly at all. And, you know, waffle is on brand with food. So
true, delicious.
If you enjoyed this podcast, you can follow Sarah on Instagram at me_and_Orla. And you can read her newsletter at meandorla@substack.com. You can also visit Sarah's website, meandorla.co.uk, to find out about her coaching courses and Insta retreats, and I'll put all those links in the show notes. You can also follow me on Instagram at Laura Price Writes for more information on my past and future podcast guests, and you can buy my novel, Single Bald Female, in bookshops and online. It's out in paperback in January 2023, and it's currently in hardback. Social media features so prominently in the novel that it's actually like another character. So if you're as fascinated as me by how much social media features in our lives, then you might want to give it a read. Now, a favour to ask. If you're enjoying this podcast, please go to Apple Podcasts or whichever platform you're listening on and give this podcast a review or rating and hit the subscribe button. It really, really helps other listeners to discover the podcast. And as an independent podcaster, that's pretty much the only tool I have. So I need your help. I'll be back in another 2 weeks with a fresh episode, and I'd love to see you there. Thank you for listening to Life in Food with Laura Price.
Hey,
Hey, folks, I'm Mark Maron from the WTF podcast, and this episode is brought to you by Kleenex Ultra Soft Tissues, your ally to help tackle your allergy symptoms this season. I love the change of seasons, but nobody loves pollen and all those other things floating in the air that make you sneeze during this nice weather. Kleenex Ultra Soft Tissues are hypoallergenic and allergist approved. So fight back against watery eyes and runny noses without worrying about irritating your skin. For this allergy season, grab Kleenex and face allergies head on.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Did you know cats tend to hide symptoms of sickness and pain? I learned this the hard way after losing my cat, Gingy. So I created Pretty Litter, a health monitoring litter that helps detect early signs of illness by changing colors, saving you money and potentially your cat's life. Pretty Litter is veterinarian developed, and it's the easiest way to keep tabs on your fur baby's health right at home.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
If you thought the only way to get a more defined jawline with natural-looking results was through surgery, think again. Juvederm Volux XC is a non-surgical injectable gel filler that improves moderate to severe loss of jawline definition and can help you achieve natural-looking results with little downtime. Even better, this improved definition lasts up to 1 year with optimal treatment. No maintenance required. Improve jawline definition for a smooth, sculpted look with Juvederm Volux XC. For important safety information and to find a licensed specialist, visit Juvederm.com. That's Juvederm.com. Not for people with severe allergic reactions, allergies to lidocaine, or the proteins used in Juvederm. Common side effects include injection site redness, swelling, pain, tenderness, firmness, lumps, bumps, bruising, discoloration, or itching. There's a risk of unintentional injection into a blood vessel, which can cause vision abnormalities, blindness, stroke, temporary scabs, or scarring. Talk to a licensed specialist to find out if it's right for you.